This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Pariskov.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Mathalul ladhina yunfiquna amwalahum fi sabilillah كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The Belarusian president says the West seeks to provoke unrest in his country as the U.S. announces sanctions against Minsk over the arrest of an opposition figure. Republicans in the U.S. Senate derail a bipartisan inquiry into the deadly assault on the Capitol by supporters of former President Donald Trump. And in Canada, a mass grave containing remains of 215 children has been found at the site of a former residential school for Indigenous children. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. The United States has announced that it will impose sanctions on Belarus over the diversion of a European passenger plane and the arrest of an opposition figure on board. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki has described last week's forced landing of a Lithuania-bound plane as a breach of international norms. Psaki said the U.S. is working with the European Union on a list of sanctions against key members of the Belarusian government. The EU has already introduced economic sanctions and urged its airline to avoid Belarus airspace. Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko has accused the West of trying to provoke unrest in his country. He made the comments while meeting his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin in the Russian resort city of Sochi. Putin has played down the controversy over the incident as a surge of emotions. Republicans in the U.S. Senate blocked the creation of an independent commission to probe the deadly raid on the Capitol building by supporters of former President Donald Trump. Only 6 Republicans joined 50 Democrats in the Senate to vote for the measure. That was 4 short of the threshold required to get the bill passed. The probe into the January 6th incident was initially backed by Republicans, but they revoked their support as the inquiry would likely affect the Congress's midterm elections next year. The Republican obstruction was slammed by the top Democrat in the Senate.
By unanimous consent, the mandatory form.
The Republican minority just mounted a partisan filibuster against an independent commission to report on January 6th. Both efforts should have moved forward in a solidly bipartisan way. But out of fear or fealty to Donald Trump, the Republican minority just prevented the American people from getting the full truth about January 6th. The Republican minority just prevented the Senate from even debating the bill. No opportunity for amendments, no opportunity for debate.
On January 6, hundreds of supporters of Donald Trump stormed the Capitol as lawmakers discussed the formal certification of Joe Biden as the U.S. president. The violence left five people, including a police officer, dead and delayed Biden's certification. Back then, both Democrats and top Republicans blamed Trump for the violence after he openly declared the presidential vote rigged. Our correspondent in Washington, Colin Campbell, has given us more details on why Republican senators blocked a bipartisan inquiry into Trump supporters' attack on the Capitol.
The decision for this commission not to be formed could mostly be put on Republicans, who said that there are other groups and committees that have been formed that will look further into the reasons and the activities leading up to the January 6th insurrection that they felt would be more detailed rather than the commission. Of course, commissions have been formed for much lesser things. We do also remember the 9/11 commission. That was also a big deal. It's very strange that Congress and members of Congress would not want a commission, considering that there have been so many commissions for several things, and that seems to get a lot of press. But that's exactly, and perhaps precisely, why Republicans did not want this extra attention to go to a commission looking into the specificity in which caused and inspired the January 6th insurrection, because it would look bad for their party. The former president, Donald Trump, still wields a lot of influence in the Republican Party. So a lot of the Republicans are going to be following the president's lead. This is the former president's lead. This would include other senators not wanting a commission. This would include other senators trying to take the focus off of insurrectionists and not going into full detail over all the arrests that need to be made and all of the investigations that need to be conducted so that this would never happen again, and to make sure that those who are responsible for the insurrection held accountable.
U.S. President Joe Biden has presented a $715 billion defense budget, which shows an increase of about $10 billion compared with the previous year. A top Pentagon official says the budget takes, quote, a clear-eyed approach to an increasingly competitive China. The budget would pay more than $5 billion for an initiative aimed at countering Beijing in the Indo-Pacific region. It calls for developing hypersonic weapons and other next-generation systems to counter Russia and China. The defense budget also earmarks more than $27 billion for modernizing the United States' nuclear arsenal. Author and columnist Einar Tangen says the U.S. President Joe Biden does not want to be perceived as a weak politician in dealing with Washington's adversaries, and that is why he has increased the country's defense budget.
Biden does not want to be seen as weak on China and Russia or its adversaries. So it's saying, yeah, look, we're putting another $10 billion into this already inflated budget. So that's his response there. On the other side, he's trying to make sure that he can say the Republicans refuse to own up to the very problems that they acknowledged on the day they were attacked. So, as I said, Biden really believes that he needs to control the narrative. So do the Republicans. For Biden, it means that he can, if he can get two or three more senators, he can get past this issue of revoking the ability to filibuster. If he's able to do that, he can get his agenda through Congress, assuming that also that he's able to control the House. And that's really what is at stake here. These are all political moves. They disregard the science and the actual needs of the Pentagon, which, as everybody knows, has never been able to pass a full audit because it has such an arcane system, in part deliberately, to hide the monies that it's supposedly using to defend the United States.
and Canada a mass grave containing remains of 215 children, some as young as 3 years old, has been found, with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau describing the discovery as heartbreaking. The remains were unearthed at the site of a former residential school for Indigenous children near the town of Kamloops in British Columbia. The bodies belong to the students of the school, but authorities say the cause and timing of the deaths are not known yet. Kamloops Indian Residential School was established in 1890, and it was closed in 1978. A 2015 investigation into Canada's residential school system concluded that the system, typically run by Christian churches, constituted cultural genocide. The report documented physical abuse, rape, malnutrition, and other atrocities against the school children. It also found that more than 4,000 children died while attending these schools. International human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan says the discovery of the bodies of Indigenous students at a former Canadian school is another example of the country's historical anti-Indigenous campaign.
But this was a cover-up. You know, when 215 people die in any sort of institution, you know, there should have been an investigation, but they're buried in secret on the property of the school. And this is, you know, is a terrible situation. In some ways, unfortunately, the people who probably buried the bodies and committed the crimes are no longer here. But the community is owes a debt to the families and to these native communities that suffered horrifically. And, you know, this has been a, you know, several hundred year campaign of cultural and even physical genocide against the native population in Canada.
Colombian President Iván Duque says he is deploying military troops in the country's third largest city, Cali, amid deadly anti-government protests there.
We have seen acts of vandalism and we have seen acts against public infrastructure. I want to make it absolutely clear. From tonight begins the maximum deployment of military assistance to the National Police in Cali and the province of Valle. This deployment will be headed by experienced officials.
Duque took the decision after four people died during protests in Cali on Friday. The deaths came as tens of thousands marched across Colombia to mark a month of anti-government demonstrations. Officials linked the fatalities to civilian shootings. Police fired tear gas and water cannons to disperse the protesters, and there have been reports of clashes between the two sides. The nationwide protests in Colombia started last month by unions against tax reforms, but have since expanded to wide-ranging demands. The protesters say they will continue their street rallies until their demands are met. The unrest has so far claimed dozens of lives in the Latin American country. Now, the commander of the Quds force of the Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says new Palestinian generations must make a plan on running the whole Palestinian territories based on the pre-1967 border. Brigadier General Ismail Ghani says such a plan is backed by the International Resistance Front and the Islamic Revolution. He said running the whole territories by the Palestinians is a divine province that will happen in the near future. He also hailed the Palestinian youth for producing resources inside their country that help them in their resistance against Israel. Ghani underlined that the Israeli regime will be forced to leave the occupied territories in a humiliating way. The Yemeni army says it has carried out fresh drone attacks against targets inside Saudi Arabia.
The Air Force has launched a counterattack on King Khaled Air Base in Khamis Mushait with two Qassem 2K drones. The designated target has been hit with high precision.
Yahya Sari says the operation was in response to Saudi Arabia's aggression against Yemeni people. The retaliatory attack on Saudi Arabia's King Khaled Air Base follows the death of three Yemenis and the shelling of Saada province by Saudi forces. The kingdom and its allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015. Tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have been killed in the onslaught. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif al-Washali, says the Yemeni army believes King Khaled Air Base is a legitimate target and they will continue hitting it.
Yemenis believe it's their right to continue targeting Saudi facilities. King Khaled Air Base especially has been used for military purposes. So the Yemeni army believes that this airport and air base is a legitimate target and will continue hitting King Khaled Air Base. Several and other targets will be also in the bank of the targets of the Yemeni army, including Aramco facilities.
Syria's President Bashar al-Assad has hailed the massive turnout in the country's presidential election held on Wednesday. He said Syrians managed to change the rules of the game in their country.
Today you have changed the rules of the game. You have also proven that the main equations are sought here, and they are written with our own hands, and there will be no rules for anyone except for our brothers and our friends. You have redefined what nationality is.
In his victory speech, Assad said the mass turnout was a revolution against corruption. He said those who turned out to vote restored the true meaning of a revolution after it was distorted by mercenaries. Assad lauded every Syrian in every city who expressed their love for the nation through mass rallies. He stressed that the Syrian people have proven their perseverance and shown capability to fight all enemies. The Syrian president said the fighting spirit is also needed for the upcoming period of constant work and resistance. Assad won a fourth term in office with more than 95% of the vote. The turnout was over 78%. Political commentator Marcus Papadopoulos says Bashar al-Assad's crushing victory has its roots in him being a wartime president who stood his ground and prevailed in his goal of keeping Syria together.
One of the major factors as to why his election victory has been so incredibly startling is because he is a wartime leader. He has led Syria through the darkest chapter in the country's history. He held himself together. He kept Syria together. He was absolutely resolute in his determination that the independence and sovereignty of Syria would not be given away to anyone and to anybody. And in doing so, he defied some of the most powerful countries in the world, namely America, Britain, France, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Israel.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Islam smashes joint Arab-Israelite attack. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Today is a memorable day in history. It is the anniversary of an immortal event that made Islam triumphant over an Arab-Israelite plot. The enemies intended to end the life and mission of the Seal of Messengers and wipe out the few faithful Muslims from the face of the earth, with the help of the fifth column in Medina, that is, the hypocrites whose hearts were devoid of faith while outwardly they professed Islam. The Holy Quran mentions this crucial happening in the Surah Al-Ahzab, which means the Confederates or the Allies, that is, the pagan Arabs and the Israelites, who besieged the city of Medina with an overwhelming force. But God Almighty routed them with winds and a sandstorm in what became known as the Battle of the Ditch, in reference to the digging of a wide trench around the city as a barrier to invasion, an unprecedented practice in Arabia. The Muslims dug a ditch, which the disbelievers were unable to cross, and eventually the enemy retreated in disarray. This is mentioned in the Holy Quran in order to remind the believers of God's goodness to them so that they may obey divine commandments, including proper conduct towards Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. and his household, or Ahlul Bayt, blessed household, peace be upon them. The hypocrites are warned of the consequences if they do not stop their bad behavior. The truly faithful are promised a great reward for the sacrifices in the way of God. The ayahs of the Holy Quran undoubtedly refer to one of the greatest events in the history of Islam, when the person who stands to this day as the model for every true believer and whose faith in God Almighty and the Prophet single-handedly brought victory to Islam and humanitarian values. Please stay with us to listen to a summarized account of the Battle of the Ditch and the heroic exploit of this champion of Islam who defeated the joint plot of the Arabs and the Israelites. Who will deal with this cur? Thus said the last and greatest prophet, whom the Almighty Creator has sent as mercy unto the whole creation, and regarding whom the Holy Quran, after lauding his limitless patience, says in Ayah 4 of Surah Al-Qalam, indeed you possess a great character. The use of the word cur here does not refer to any canine breed, but, as is clear by the tone of the phrase, it is a disdainful remark for someone whose behavior has made him worse than a rabid dog. This phrase was not used by a person unacquainted with ethics or the etiquette of speech. These are not the words of any impatient and haughty soul unable to control his emotions or tongue. In fact, it is the expression of the man regarding whom the Lord Most High tells us in the opening ayahs of Surah Najm in the Holy Quran, your companion has neither gone astray nor gone amiss, nor does he speak out of his own desire. It is just a revelation that is revealed to him. In view of this fact, it is thus clear that the cur referred to by the last and greatest messenger of God had committed a cardinal sin and deserved capital punishment. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, was asking his companions to mete out justice that the cur deserved. Those still in the dark about the identity of the cur and the unpardonable crime he committed ought to know the significance of the 17th of Shawwal in Islamic history. On this day, in the year 5 AH, a formidable 10,000 strong combined force of Arab infidels and Israelites approached the city of Medina with the intention of killing the Holy Prophet and obliterating Islam. To the surprise of the Arab and Israelite confederates, a ditch blocked their assault on the city. It was a new tactic in warfare in Arabia, thanks to the suggestion of a new companion of the Holy Prophet, Salman al-Farsi, or the Persian, who was from Iran. As the siege of the city of Medina prolonged and the patience of the besiegers began to wear thin, the pagan Arab leader, Abu Sufyan, in consultation with his Israelite accomplices, thought that the veritable giant, Amr ibn Abdawad, along with a handful of roughnecks, could deliver the coup de grace to Muslims, since the fifth column in Medina was also impatiently awaiting the end of the Holy Prophet and Islam. The arrogant Arab and his ignorant band leapt across the ditch at its narrowest point and challenged the Muslims to individual combat, as was the custom. Amr ibn Abdawad, the infidel, blasphemously thrust his spear in the Prophet's tent while grunting his challenge, fully aware that the hypocrites among the Muslims will discourage and dishearten the few faithful by praising his physical strength and brutality of character. It is now clear why the Holy Prophet of Peace called Amr ibn Abdawad a cur and why he gave the verdict for capital punishment. In other words, anyone, even a self-styled Muslim, who dares to desecrate the sanctity of the residence, however temporary, of a representative of God, is worse than a rabid dog and should be dispatched to the bowels of hell. Where is Islamic conscience these days? A few years ago, a terrorist outfit masquerading as Muslims had destroyed the blessed tomb of Prophet Jonah or Prophet Yunus in the Iraqi city of Mosul. With the arms and money supplied by the Wahhabi cult, which in 1925 had committed the sacrilege of desecrating and demolishing the graves of the elite of Islam at the Jannat al-Baqi cemetery in the city of Medina, especially the holy shrine housing the resting place of four of the 12 infallible heirs of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon them. Now, speaking about hypocrisy, the Almighty informs us in the Holy Quran about the hypocrites who were among the Holy Prophet's companions during the Battle of the Ditch, in ayahs 12 to 15 of Surah Ahzab in the Holy Quran. And when the hypocrites were saying, as well as those in whose hearts is a sickness, Allah and His Prophet did not promise us anything except delusion. And when a group of them said, O people of Yathrib, this is not a place for you, so go back. And a group of them sought the Prophet's permission, saying, Our homes lie exposed to the enemy, although they were not exposed. They only sought to flee. Had they been invaded from its flanks, and had they been asked to apostatize, they would have done so with only a mild hesitation, though they had certainly pledged to Allah before that they would not turn their backs to flee, and pledges given to Allah are accountable. Up then, when no one dared to meet the challenge of Amr ibn Abdawad the cur, the Prophet's cousin and son-in-law, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, calmly rose and volunteered to finish off the task. The Holy Prophet sent him to fight as the embodiment of all faith, saying, forth to confront the embodiment of all infidelity. The rest is history. Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, after inviting Amr ibn Abdawad to Islam and receiving a negative reply, sent him to the netherworld, but not before allowing him to renew the life and death combat, because the cowardly infidel had hurled to the ground, had dared to spit at his opponent. That was the reason Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, hailed Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib's selfless feat that was solely for the sake of God, and without personal emotions becoming involved in the combat. The Holy Prophet of Islam said, The stroke of Ali on the day of the ditch is greater than the worship of all mankind and jinn.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Underwater of the North Sea.
Part 1.
I learned to swim in the murky waters of the North Sea, where lie the remnants of 5 centuries of naval battles. I found this submerged world even more fascinating as it was hidden. Through diving, I understood the extent of the military debris left behind by the 20th century. Because in the North Sea and the Baltic Sea, the Allies deliberately sunk ships transporting hundreds of millions of tons of chemical weapons. Today, we are holding more and more commemorations for both world wars, while under the sea, the metallic fuselages holding these substances are corroding. If we don't take action, scientists predict an unprecedented catastrophe.
The munitions are silent killers that are basically the chemical releases from them are drifting in the ocean as we speak today.
Why were these chemical weapons dumped in the sea? What action can we take to protect man and the environment before it's too late? Because this dreadful legacy is ready to resurface, as if the salt water was preventing history's scars to heal. At the start of the 20th century, the North Sea is the confrontation site for the industrial nations. France, the Netherlands, the UK, Belgium, and Germany battle over commercial and political geoeconomics. Europe's first industrial war sees the development of new weapons, like the submarine, the airplane, tanks, and deadly chemical weapons.
replacing the usual racket of infantry attacks, I imagined the deathly silence of a 168-ton green cloud descending upon the French front lines and instantly gassing around 15,000 soldiers. The Germans used chlorine gas as a weapon for the first time in 1915, close to Ypres in Flanders. The world had just entered the realms of chemical weapons. During World War I, all warring nations developed gas weapons. Soldiers protect themselves with sophisticated masks. The substances can be detected by their odors. Phosphorus smells like freshly cut hay. Mustard gas, also called Yprite, in memory of its deadly use in Ypres, smells like garlic. Lewisite has the scent of geraniums, and hydrogen cyanide evokes bitter almonds. These olfactory clues will be corrected by German chemists, and the next generation of gases will kill with complete discretion. I wondered what had become of these toxic arsenals following armistice. I was surprised to discover that access to French military archives was forbidden. On the other hand, in the archives of the Belgian Royal Army, I found a document from May 1919 advising war ministries to clear their territory of abandoned ammunition and notably of asphyxiation gases. It says that the most effective way is to sink this ammunition in the sea. Ministers ordered the 35,000 tons of chemical weapons to be dumped on the sandbanks of Paardenmarkt, a stone's throw away from the swanky Nacka beach. Because this location is very close to a densely populated zone, today it is the best documented in Europe.
The dump site has been there for a long time. It has been there since 1919, when chemical munitions that were found in Belgium after the end of the First World War, it was mainly German munition. A lot of accidents happened, explosions, so they wanted to get rid of this dangerous munition. And they chose to dump it very close to the shore, so they could use small boats. They would not have to go very far, but because it was quite dangerous to transport a lot of chemical munition over a long distance.
...35,000 tons of chemical weapons, the equivalent of more than 1,000 of our current lorries. A few hundred meters away from the industrial port of Zeebrugge and Nacka Beach. In addition to the danger of this proximity, the depth of the site is extremely weak, with some of the depot zones less than 1 meter away. Today, the currents have covered the bombs in a layer of sand and sea sediment. Is it the opacity of the North Sea or the hazards of turbulent history that have made the site disappear from memories?
It was finished, I think, in spring 1920, and then everybody forgot about it. Until in the 1970s, they were doing maintenance works for the harbor of Zeebrugge, and then a dredging vessel hit upon big obstacles on the seafloor, let's say.
Today, the official position is that those responsible for this dumping were not aware of the potential dangers. Yet from 1919 onwards, the mayor of Kanake was warned about the chemical dumping on the beaches of his commune. He writes a letter to the war ministry in which he outlines his concerns for the health of coastlines and the future of coastline fishing. The ministry responds dryly. It's the fastest solution, and the dangers you allude to will not occur. Yet now we know that their deterioration in water can increase harmfulness.
The major danger comes from the Clark compound, from the arsenic compound, because also most of the breakdown products, when the product breaks down because it's in water, are equally toxic. They can stay toxic for a very long time. Mustard gas, it's not a gas. None of these are really gases. It's like a liquid, it's a very thick liquid. And if it's in the seawater for a long time, it will become brittle and hard, so it will become a sort of lump. But if this lump is very toxic, but it stays in place, you know, it's a problem, but it's very localized. It doesn't spread very far.
For security reasons, it's forbidden to fish and to throw down anchors in the zone. But sailing is not forbidden there, and I still see my childhood sailing school drifting around there. The biggest threat would be a shipwreck in the zone. In 2001, a ship container was washed up close to the site. If the ship's bow had turned over the Partenmarkt sands, the boat would have caused an explosion, contaminating the coasts of Belgium, Holland, and France. Must we wait for an unprecedented maritime catastrophe to inspect the state of shell corrosion?
In 1972, there is a report that stated that the state of the munition shells is relatively good. But since then, we are more than 40 years later, we don't know how good or bad is the state of the munition. So that is something we would like to know. Perhaps the shells are still intact, or perhaps quite a lot of them have already corroded.
All North Sea and Baltic coasts are affected, and new sites appear. In the North Sea, over 50 sites are identified. This figure doesn't include many forgotten cases of dumping, so it's impossible to make a precise list of all the dumping sites. France, the country most affected by the submersion, obstructs all attempts to access information on the dumping. Once again in the Belgian archives, I find a letter from the War Ministry advising English and French methods as a source of inspiration. I'm not the first person to delve into these embarrassing papers, as the information memo concerning France has disappeared.
I cannot imagine that France does not have any dump sites, be it for conventional munition or chemical munition. There must be, but we know absolutely nothing about it.
The French army refuses all access to its very secret defense archives, the highest military classification. While scrutinizing navigation maps, I discover over 60 forbidden zones along the French coast, including one in front of Gravelines, where the Belgians dumped German chemical shells. Regional newspaper archives report daily submersions close to Dunkirk, at Boulogne-sur-Mer, at that time the leading French fishing port, but also at Cherbourg, with production of chemical weapons cease after World War I. Not only was everyone expecting World War II to be a chemical war, but from 1934 onwards, the Nazis discover a new family, neurotoxins. They are 10,000 times more effective than the gases used in World War I. The chemical weapons race begins again in between wars. In preparation for the bombing of the Russian army, the Luftwaffe equips itself with these weapons that only the Germans possess. And yet these chemical strikes will never see the light of day, despite the help of Nazi dignitaries who dream of destroying the Red Army after the Stalingrad defeat. German chemical domination should have delayed the end of the conflict, but in the summer of 1945, Germany is defeated without having used its secret weapons. Its immense arsenal is recovered by the Allies. The victors meet at Potsdam, where an embarrassing question is raised. What to do with the 300,000 tons left behind by the losers? Like after World War I, the decision is made to dump these chemical weapons in the sea, but this time in Atlantic gulfs deeper than 1,000 meters. Today, we know that these remote destinations were not adhered to, as the ammunition was submerged in the Baltic Sea at a depth of between 40 and 100 meters. What are the consequences for man and the environment? To find out, I visit the Danish island of Bornholm that suffers the most accidents. It was even easier to dump in the sea, as little was known about the seabed. In ancient times, it was even considered infinite like the sky. Furthermore, don't we also find stars in the oceans? As I approach the island by turboprop, I gaze upon the sapphire blue of the most polluted ocean in the world. After World War II, the island is occupied by the Red Army for 11 months. Before leaving, the Soviets dump tens of thousands of tons of mustard gas seized on the Eastern Front during their infiltration towards Berlin.
Fisherman in 50 years, in Bornholm and also in North Sea. I buy my first ship in 1972. And after this, I have had ship all the time. So it must be about 45 years about, yeah. And then if you say sinus gas, it seems like syrup, yeah? But I have see if you put it direct on the people, yeah? I think it take maybe 5 minutes for people to die, yeah? So it's very strong. We take it up in the evening. About 7, 6 o'clock in the evening, yeah? And also we have some bomb, but there's only some steel, yeah? We don't see gas. We take the bomb and jump out again, clean fish and, yeah. Go to sleep in the night and wake up maybe 1, 2 o'clock in the night. And then they burn too much around your hands, yeah? And be more and more. And then we take up the trawl and go to harbor, but we have 6 hours sailing from the fishing ground to the harbor, yeah? And they're burning more and more, you know? Believe me, you know, the hand was too high, I think, yeah? All this burning. The skin, everything is off, yeah? So you take some skin from my stomach and put over in my hand. And you can see it now, it's all the way. But all the fingers are working, but working are good. We have Sweden here, Bornholm here, and Poland here, yeah, and Germany, yeah. And if you go a little bit in, we have Christians Island here, just 12 miles from Bornholm, And the area is about 12 miles east from Christianside. It's about the same place as two yellow sheep there. But now are we fishing in this area? Because there's also good fish here.
The fishermen say that the forbidden zone, the competition between boats, is not as strong. The problem is that trawling scrapes the seabed and disperses the ammunition even more when it doesn't explode. In 50 years, more than 600 accidents have occurred on this underwater powder keg.
Choose the drugs. I'm hepatitis C positive. I'm HIV positive.
Every morning starts with the sound of ambulances down here.
In the limelight.
A mass grave containing the remains of 215 indigenous children has been discovered on the grounds of a former residential school in the interior of southern British Columbia in Canada. The grim discovery at the former school near the town of Kamloops was announced late on Thursday, 27th of May. By the Tekemloops Tessekwapempk people after the site were examined by a team using ground-penetrating radar. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Tracy Lindman. The piece is titled Canada, Remains of 215 Children Found at Indigenous Residential School Site. Please stay with us for more of Tracy Lindman's article. Grave containing the remains of 215 indigenous children has been discovered on the grounds of a former residential school in the interior of southern British Columbia in Canada. The grim discovery at the former school near the town of Kamloops was announced late on Thursday, 27th of May, by the Tekemloops Tessekwapempk people after the site was examined by a team using ground-penetrating radar. We had a knowing in our community that we were able to verify. To our knowledge, these missing children are undocumented deaths, said Roseanne Casimir, chief of the indigenous Tekemloops Tessekwapempk people, in a statement. Some of the remains belong to children as young as 3 years old, but the causes and timing of their deaths are not yet known. At this time, we have more questions than answers, said Roseanne Casimir. The Kamloops Indian Residential School was established in 1890 under the leadership of the Roman Catholic Church and closed in 1978. It was part of a cross-Canada network of residential schools created to forcibly assimilate Indigenous Red Indian children by removing them from their homes and communities and forbidding them from speaking their native languages or performing cultural practices. Physical, emotional, and sexual abuse were rampant within these institutions, as was forced labor. least 150,000 indigenous children attended such schools in what a historic 2015 Truth and Reconciliation Commission described as a culture of genocide targeting Canada's indigenous Indian people. In documents submitted to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, former Kamloops attendees described the harsh conditions of the school, which did not receive enough per capita funding from the Canadian government to pay for its costs. George Manuel, who attended the school in the 1920s, said, "Every Indian student smelled of hunger. The school was described as being cold in winter and unsanitary." The same